My original thought was that we would conclude with our series Perfectly Fair and Perfect Justice, this being part three. And as we made the introduction to this part of it last week, talking about the Sanhedrin, talking about just how utterly unjust the trial of Jesus was. And it was really to set the stage and introduce to you the judicial system in which God set up in the nation of Israel. In the situation in which Jesus, by all rights, should have faced. But he didn't face that kind of a situation. So we introduced that last week, and we're going to finish possibly this week. We will get through the main part, but really all we're going to have time to look at is the religious part of the trial. We're not even going to have time yet to go into the secular portion, which is Pilate. So that tells you just how much was wrong with the part of the trial that goes before, that takes place with Sanhedrin. And looking at the events from the arrest at night through his execution, we see that there really is two trials that Jesus faces. There's that religious trial that he faces, the Jewish trial. And then he also faces a Roman secular trial. And with each of those has three phases. So the trial of Jesus is actually quite complex. You know, as we're going to dive into this religious aspect, you have the first part, which he goes to Annas, and then he gets sent to Caiaphas, and there's a trial with the members of the Sanhedrin there at night, again, which is illegal, and then they have a sham showing in the morning. So you got those three phases. Well, you have the same thing with the secular trial, and that is Jesus is sent to Pontius Pilate, then he's sent to Herod, then he's sent back to Pontius Pilate. So both of them have three phases. And again, we're only going to really get to the Jewish trial itself. In that Jewish trial, again, I mentioned that he went to Annas. He was the former high priest. So if you've read the Gospels and you're wondering what's going on, why does it say that Annas is the high priest, and why does it say that Caiaphas is the high priest? As we're going to talk about, Annas was the high priest years before, and now his son-in-law Caiaphas is the high priest. So he will eventually go to Caiaphas and have a nighttime trial in front of the Sanhedrin. And again, then he'll go to Pontius Pilate. But really, there's one verse. If you want to turn with me to the book of John, you have your bulletin. You'll know our memory verse. It's been the same for the past 2 weeks now, actually. Took that long for me to get to the verse, really. John chapter 18. There's really one verse, I think, that sums up this whole wicked event of the trial of Jesus. If there's one that really can sum up what's going on? John chapter 18, verse 23. Jesus asks a question, and we're going to get to this point in the story in a few minutes. But skipping ahead, I want you to think of this verse really as it relates to the whole trial. John chapter 18, verse 23. Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why smitest thou me?" And really, that comes down to the whole situation with Jesus' trial. The things that he has spoken for the past 3 years has been evil. Then testify of it. Bring forth your argument. Bring forth your testimony. "But if I speak well, and what I say is true, why do you smite me?" Now here he's in response to because he was smacked. But in the whole big picture, if what I am doing is true, is right, why do you smite me? And think of that in the bigger sense. As Jesus was smitten, he was stricken for our transgressions. So Jesus, whether it's here during the trial or whether it's in his ministry, he didn't speak any evil. He never spoke any evil. Never once did he speak any evil. If Jesus was guilty, it was guilty of pointing out the truth to those leaders of Israel who cared only for their power, their prestige, and their wealth. That's what they cared about. They didn't care about what was true. The trial of Jesus, as Jesus puts it, is the hour of darkness. That's what Jesus himself calls the trial. He calls it the hour of darkness. Those who conducted the trial of Jesus, they wanted him dead. His fate in their minds was decided well before this trial. We know that from Scripture too. That Caiaphas prophesied of Jesus' death that he should die for the nation, so that only one would die for the nation. That happened before the trial. It was decided before. This really is, as we're going to see, the hour of darkness. Otherwise, even the guards, and we're going to turn to Luke here in a second. Otherwise, even the guards who came to arrest Jesus would have refused their orders. In the United States military, believe it or not, you can refuse orders given by your commanding officer. Whenever I joined the Navy, you know, it's not like they publicize this in some grand scale, but you are made known in your handbook that if you are given an immoral order, you have the right to refuse to do it. Matter of fact, if you're very familiar with World War II, and especially the trial of Nuremberg, after those trials, what was it that the officers and the men in the army or the SS who were on trial at Nuremberg, what did they try to say? Well, I was just following orders. What did the judges say? No, not so. You don't get off that easy. See, there are certain orders in which you should never follow. And so they didn't get up. They're not innocent by any means. And so even in that event, turn to Luke chapter 22 for particularly interesting aspects, a reminder. These officers of the court who came to arrest Jesus must have known, had to have known, that there was something different about this Jesus. And they knew it. They saw it. And they still went forward. Luke 22, starting verse 49. You guys are pretty, I'm sure, familiar with Jesus being arrested. Remember everybody, all of his friends are falling asleep, and he tells them, don't fall asleep. And he's praying. He says, can't you stay awake with me? And then the guards come to arrest him. Let's pick it up here in verse 49. It says, when they which were about him saw what would follow, they said unto him, Lord, shall we smite with the sword? So in other words, whenever his disciples and his apostles saw what was getting ready to transpire, they saw that he's getting ready to get arrested. What is it that happens? That his disciples, particularly Peter, we find out that it's Peter, he says, should we smite with a sword? Verse 50, and one of them smote the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. Now we know, again, that this is Peter who does this. And so, and actually, if you go over to John's version of this, we know the name of this particular guard. Malchus is the one whose ear was cut off, and he actually comes back into the story later, which we don't have time to go into that. So he cuts off the right ear. And what is it that Jesus does about it? He heals it. Verse 51, and Jesus answered and said, suffer ye this far, and he touched his ear, and he healed him. This officer sent to arrest Jesus has to know, wait a minute, my ear was cut off and Jesus healed me. There's something different about this guy. This guy go and testify later to Jesus' defense? No. Matter of fact, and I don't know that we're not going to really have time to really talk about this much. But I'm not going to talk about it. We'll talk about it later. Hopefully, get ahead of myself. And this event right here, just to drive home the point, this event with him getting his ear cut off and getting healed, this is after the guards show up and Jesus sees them coming and he says, who are you looking for? And they say, we're looking for Jesus from Nazareth. Anybody remember Jesus' response? I am he. And what happened to those guards? They fell down backwards. the power of Jesus' statement, I am he, literally, according to scripture, made the guards fall backwards. They knew, wait a minute, this isn't just some false messiah. This isn't just some guy that's got some fame. The power of him saying, I am, which, by the way, he will say those two words again whenever he's asked, are you the Christ? Are you the Son of God? And he says, I am. There's power in those words. And so as we look at the events that day, keep in mind, nobody is innocent of what's going on here. Nobody's innocent. So let's get to the trial. Back to John, chapter 18. And we're going to pick up in verse 10. John 18, verse 10. Here we pick up where we left off in Luke. John 18, 10 says, then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and smote the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So that's the parallel passage from Luke 22. Then said Jesus unto Peter, put up thy sword into thy sheath. The cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink? This thing was set long before you, Peter. Don't try to stop. Then the band, verse 12, and the captain and the officers and of the Jews took Jesus and bound him. And I would also, I would put a note, underline that he was bound. Keep in mind that the sacrifices in Israel, they were bound. Here Jesus is being bound and ultimately led to the slaughter, just like the sacrifices in Israel. Verse 13, we're introduced after he's taken away to the first part of the actual trial. It says, and led him away. They led Jesus away to Annas first, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. And so this Annas, we talked about a little bit last week in our introduction to the trial. Annas is the former, we actually know quite a bit about Annas. He's the former high priest, and he was the father to five succeeding high priests. And then also the father-in-law of the current high priest, who is Caiaphas. And so, obviously, if you remember, high priests were supposed to serve for life. And so the Romans, obviously, are the ones who removed Annas. Speculation is because he had so much power, he had so much influence. And I can tell you, he did have quite a bit of power. Because when he wasn't in office, his five different sons took the position, and then his son-in-law took the position. That is seven straight administrations which he has the major influence of. If there is a dynasty that's going on, Annas has it. And he has great wealth. He has great power. He has controlled the position of the high priesthood for seven different terms, so to speak. So he was a very powerful man. And if we believe, as we should, that the money changers and those purchases of sacrifices, whenever you would come to the temple to make your temple sacrifice and they would sell you one, a sacrifice, if you're to believe, as you should, that those money changers and those purchases were a corrupt system, who do you think was the main profiteer from this? Annas. Annas would have been the main profiteer from this whole rigged system. So when Jesus comes in and he turns over the tables, the money changers, and he drives them out with a whip, not once but twice, who do you think is probably madder than anyone else? Annas. Annas probably does not like this guy Jesus here. He is the first person that Jesus has led to, which Annas, by law, has no authority over Jesus. So many would speculate that really what this has to do with is drumming up charges against Jesus, drumming up something that they can charge Jesus with. And so this is who they lead him with. Let's pick up in verse 14. Now Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one should die for the people. And again, that had already happened. So we already know the mindset of these people who are putting Jesus on trial. And again, if you did not listen to last week's message, setting the stage of the way God demanded the justice system of Israel be one of mercy and justice and truth, you need to keep that in mind through all of this. If these men were to be honest and to be sincere, much like we see today in our court system, they would have recused themselves from trying Jesus. But they never did. Did not. Verse 15. Let's finish verse 14. Oh, I'm sorry. We did finish 14. Verse 15. And Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. That would be John. That disciple was known unto the high priest and went in with Jesus into the palace of the high priest. And so John, you get a little tidbit here. The high priest knew John. So John was probably somebody of a reputable background. And so John is the one that actually helps get Peter into the door because Peter was stopped. And so John, whenever you compile all the different versions, we see that John helps Peter get in. Verse 16, we see this, but Peter stood at the door without. In other words, he wasn't in. Then went out that other disciple, which is John, which was known unto the high priest and spoke unto her that kept the door and brought in Peter. So you're getting the details here that Peter is standing outside. John goes and brings him in. Then said the damsel, here's the first time that Peter denies him. Then said the damsel that kept the door unto Peter, art not they also one of this man's disciples? He saith, I am not. And so Peter denies I and says, I'm not. And the servants and the officers stood there who had made a fire of coals, for it was cold, and they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. Peter's standing with these guys. It's interesting. Now, it could be trying to listen in or something like that. I don't know. Verse 19, the high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. Verse 20, Jesus answered him. Jesus' answer is remarkable. He says, I spoke openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple where the Jews always resort, and in secret have I said nothing. Why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me what I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I've said. And when he had thus spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, answerest thou the high priest so? Now, if you remember if you're familiar with the situation when Paul goes before the high priest, Paul gets into a similar situation. And Paul responds whenever he says something technically that's evil. He says something that he shouldn't say to the high priest. And he gets hit. And then he says, oh, I didn't know it was the high priest because otherwise I wouldn't have said something so evil. What's interesting is not only does Jesus not say anything evil, because what he says to him is literally by the law. Just like in court today, if they bring you before a judge, do you think the judge can sit there and demand that the accused speak? No. Annas, first of all, had no right to be trying Jesus. Second of all, no one who tried Jesus had any right to demand that he convict himself, give testimony. And so what Jesus says to him is by the law of Moses, it's that if I've always spoken openly, you don't need to listen to my words. Go listen to the words who heard me. And if there's somebody who's going to say I said something evil, make them come before the court and swear by their own blood. Go listen to them. So what Jesus says isn't evil. And then what happens? He gets smacked. And that led us to what became our memory verse. And Jesus gets, like I said, smacked. In verse 23, Jesus answered him, if I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil, but if well, why smitest thou me? Talking to the person that hit him. Here we see now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. So at this point, Annas can't come up with anything against Jesus. Jesus doesn't testify and say he did anything wrong. He says, look, you got somebody who's going to say something that I did wrong, bring him forward. You know, go get it. Make your charge. But otherwise, I don't have to answer you, is what Jesus is saying. So in verse 17, we see Peter's denial. And remember that Peter could testify, as we talked about last week, Peter could testify on behalf of Jesus. Same could John. And this is why I would tell you that Peter would be so ashamed of his actions. Because according to the law of Moses, anybody who is on trial, and again, technically, he's going to go before Caiaphas and the whole Sanhedrin, and there Peter and John, when it comes to people, witnesses, it's echoes from Jesus' friends. There is no Peter. There is no John. None of his 12 show up. And you want to know why they would be upset? Because they know that by law, they had the right to walk into there and present the case and saying, he claims to be the Messiah, and I'm here to tell you it's true. So when Peter denies Christ, it's not just that he says, I don't know him. He himself denies Jesus a fair trial by not going forward. So keep that in mind. Verse 19 through 21, Jesus says, why do you ask me? I taught openly. Go ask them. Now, when I tell you that, who was just outside the gate or outside the door? Peter and John, just outside. In verses 22 through 23, we see Jesus is slapped, and you see his response. And like I said, if you compare that to what Paul does, Paul admits that he responded with evil. You want to talk about perfectly fair and perfect justice. Even in that moment, whenever Jesus is going before the legal court, being with drummed up charges, when he's done nothing wrong, and he answers the question in a righteous way, and he's slapped, in that moment, he still treats it in a perfect way. And he simply asks and makes the statement, if I've spoken evil, tell me. But if I've spoken well, why do you hit me? Even in that response, he turns it right back on the accusers and say, you're judging me, but your actions judge you. And that should give you chills, church. That should give you chills. Because everything that Jesus does that shows that he is more than one step ahead of those people that are trying to charge him. In verse 24, we see that Annas sends him to Caiaphas. And really, for those details, we got to go over to the book of Matthew, because here in John, we don't really get those deep details. Go over to Matthew chapter, and actually, before you go there, I do want to look at one more thing. Well, actually, go ahead and go over there. Matthew chapter 26, if we're going to go. In verse 57, where we're going to pick up. Matthew chapter 26, verse 57. Here, Matthew's, he picks up basically from the arrest, and he talks about the going straight to Caiaphas. And so here we could pick up the details of that situation. And what we're going to see here in these next few verses, verses 57 through 62, there's going to be false witnesses who come against Jesus. And not only false witnesses, but we're going to see that those men who were supposed to be the judges become the prosecuting attorneys. And they try to drum up false witnesses. And then Jesus doesn't ultimately even answer. Pick up in verse 7, or 57 of Matthew 26. And they that had laid a hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But Peter followed him afar off unto the high priest's palace and went in and sat with the servants to see the end. Now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witnesses against Jesus to put him to death. Now, the court that was supposed to never accept false witnesses. One of the mandates for the court, for the Sanhedrin, whenever it was first instituted, one of the mandates was that they were supposed to punish. And we looked at this last week. You go back to Deuteronomy, it's very clear. Not only should they not seek after witnesses at all, they certainly should never take the testimony of a false witness. And if there was a false witness that came forth, what was the requirement if they knew it was false? That you do unto others as they would have had done unto them. And so if this was a trial, that the penalty would be death, what is supposed to happen to any false witness?
Death.
Death. That was supposed to be the event. But here we see that they sought false witnesses. This was not a fair trial, at least. They sought false testimony, and so, but yet, they even have problems with that. Continue to read on, but they found none. So they sought, well, verse 59, I don't want to not point out, they sought false witnesses against Jesus to put him to death, because that was their goal, that was their desire. Verse 60, but found none, yea, though many false witnesses came. So what does that mean? They found none, but many false witnesses came. Well, obviously, there was going to be some level of agreement between these witnesses. But what we're going to see is even the ones that they let testify, even they don't agree with each other. And again, what was the requirement for the Sanhedrin for a witness to testify? They would need to know the hour. They would need to know the particulars of that particular event. They cannot come in there and just say, yeah, I think about a month ago I saw this guy saying something about the temple. You know, yeah, he was talking about destroying the temple. No, you got to know the details. Otherwise, your testimony's thrown out. And these guys don't come with those details. Matter of fact, they don't agree with each other. And if you compare the different versions of what's being said, they don't agree at all. Verse 60, but found none, yea, though many of the false witnesses came, yet found they none. At the last came two false witnesses and said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. Now, we know that that's not what Jesus said. And so that means that's not what they heard, which means they lied. Verse 62, and the high priest arose and said unto him, answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witnesses against thee? Verse 63, but Jesus kept his peace. And so what we're seeing in verse 62 is just like with Annas, Jesus refuses to answer. He's not obligated to answer. He's not there to do the job for them. If they've got a case, they need to make it. He's basically saying to Annas and Caiaphas, if you have a case, make your case. In verses 63 through 64, he held his peace, and the high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living God, that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. Now, understand this. All of the events of Jesus' life, all of the events of Jesus' ministry have led to this question. To this moment, to this specific event in which Jesus is asked on trial before the ruling leaders, religious leaders, the Sanhedrin, the high priest, the ones who were supposed to bow down before the Lord God of all. All of those, everything has led to this moment so that Jesus can testify openly about who he is. And in previous times, he was saying, it's not time for me to reveal it, but guess what it is? Right now is the time. All of the events have led to this. It's a moment that God presents. This is the moment. Think of it. This is the moment that God presents his Messiah officially to Israel. See, he had demonstrated who he was throughout these years. But this is the moment that he speaks for himself as the representative, as God himself, and says, I am he. From the beginning of the time of the world, Genesis chapter 3, you have the first prophecy of the Messiah. There was no revelation as to, at that point, as to who he would come from other than a woman. But then the time comes later that he says, you, O Israel, will be the one in which I will bring him forth. All of the times of the ages have led to this very moment where the high priest says, and I'll read it again, I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. 64, he says, thou hast said, nevertheless, I say unto you, hereafter shall you see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Now, in Mark 14, and we won't go there for time's sake. Well, yeah, we will. We'll make time. Look at Mark after 14. We're told something else that Jesus said in this question. And I believe it's both are true. Mark 14, verse 62. Well, we'll start in verse 60. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, answerest thou nothing? What is it that these witnesses against thee? And again, before I even go there, keep in mind at this point, you've had two false witnesses who can't agree with each other. You've got one who comes and says that he said he could destroy the temple. One that comes and said that he will destroy the temple. One says that he can build it up again with no hands. And the other one says something totally different. So you have two witnesses that don't agree with each other. And at this point, does John walk in the room and say, high priest, I was there. I can tell you what he said. Nobody does. You want to talk about the most unjust situation in trial. You want to talk about being completely abandoned, but yet being completely righteous. This is that moment that nobody comes to help him. And he was fine with that. Mark 14, verse 61, but he held his peace and answered nothing. Again, the high priest asked him and said unto him, art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And notice the answer here. Jesus said, I am. You shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. And so what we see here is in this parallel passage that Jesus makes again a declaration that I am. A fitting answer because Jesus was and is the Son of God, but he was convicted without any proof otherwise. He was simply convicted for answering the question. Are you the Son of God? And he says, I am. Guilty, they said. There's no evidence against him for being the Son of God. He was simply convicted for claiming it. And what was the response by the high priest of God? The one who was supposed to be serving the Lord, who stood bound before him. Caiaphas rents his clothes. And again, I want to paint the picture to you. The one that stood before him who just said, I am, which he has said many times, and he's declaring himself to be the Messiah. Does Caiaphas bow down and worship him? Does Caiaphas humbly realize that he is talking about the one in which God has prophesied from the beginning of time that would come? Caiaphas' response is to do another illegal act. He rents his clothes, which is an illegal act in itself for a high priest to do. It was unlawful for a high priest to do what he just did. Let's read on. When he rents his clothes, is what he says. Verse 62, Jesus says, I am. You know, the right hand of God, you'll see me coming in the clouds of heaven. Verse 63, then the high priest rent his clothes and said, what need we any further witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What thank you? And all condemned him to be guilty. And again, like I said, this was an illegal act in itself. Turn with me to Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 10, verse 6. You see, if you study the Old Testament, there's plenty of times you'll find people rent their clothes. I'm sure you're familiar with that, right? But guess who the one person in Israel who was never supposed to do that under any circumstances? The high priest. And guess what the one, if you just do a word search or those who rent their clothes, guess who you'll never find who did? Or Caiaphas, anyway, the high priest. Prophets would do it. Kings would do it. But not the high priest. Leviticus chapter 10, verse 6. Moses said unto Aaron, and unto Eleazar, and unto Ithamar, his sons, uncover not your heads, neither rent your clothes, lest you die, and lest wrath come upon all the people. But let your brethren, the whole house of Israel, bewail the burning which the Lord hath kindled. Turn to chapter 21 of Leviticus. Chapter 21, verse 10. Leviticus chapter 21, verse 10. He that is the high priest among his brethren, upon whose head the anointing oil was poured, and that is consecrated to put on the garments, shall not uncover his head nor rent his clothes. Chapter 21, verse 10. You see, Caiaphas has no interest in doing what's right. Either he's so ignorant he doesn't know what he's supposed to do, or he's so much there for the effect of drama, which is probably the case. This was an act of dramatic effect. But even that act in itself was completely forbidden. Verses, go back to Mark chapter 14. Mark 14, we'll pick up in verse 64. Again, while you're turning there, I'll repeat the verse we read a minute ago. The high priest says, you have heard the blasphemy. What thank you? And they all condemned him to be guilty of death. Now keep in mind, this is the evening portion. This is the illegal nighttime trial that took place immediately after Anna sent him over to Caiaphas. In this particular meeting, only a select group of the Sanhedrin was there. Only a select group. There's going to be a morning trial as well. But this is that evening trial. Verse 65, notice what they did next. Some began to spit on him, and some to cover his face and to buffet him, in other words, to strike him, and to say unto him, prophesy. What are they doing? They spit in his face. They strike him. They cover his face with probably some cloth, and they hit him some more, and they say, prophesy. Tell us which one of us just hit you, mocking him. And this is only phase two of six phases of Jesus' trial. This is what's going on. They beat him. They mocked him. They spit on him. And in the morning, they will have a quick pronouncement of guilt, which is illegal again, as we talked about yet last week. There never should have been a trial at night. And any verdict of guilt required there be a day between the two mandated gatherings. So in other words, you could have the trial in the right place at the right time, conducted in the right way. And if there's a guilty understanding, you had to wait a full day. And what were you supposed to do that day? You were supposed to fast. You were supposed to only be dealing with that issue right there and not have the trial conclude the next day. What is it that Israel, the Sanhedrin, does? They had the trial at night. They don't fast. They finish the trial in the morning. And then they break the law by sending him over to Pontius Pilate. There's no justification in Israel's justice system to do something like that. Some would say that that's because they didn't have the right to put Jesus to death, and that may be the case. But I would remind you that many people were nearly stoned to death. Jesus himself, one of the situations you're familiar with, is whenever Jesus is sitting there and they want to stone this woman to death because she had committed adultery, right? The answer wasn't, well, you can't put her to death. You got to take her to the Romans. So I don't know that it's necessarily accurate when you hear people say that the Jews themselves couldn't put people to death. I don't know if that was the case or not. I know that they sure stoned Stephen. I know that they sure stoned Paul. So what we do know is that almost everything, well, everything that took place was completely illegal. Then after that quick morning sham of a trial where the Sanhedrin declares him guilty, they send him off to Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate, as we know, desires to set him free eventually. But it was illegal for them to do that. And so Pilate sends him to Herod, and Herod looking at him more like a toy or a pet, trying to get him to do tricks. Sends him back to Pilate. Jesus is scourged. In other words, he's beaten again. Why? Why did all this take place? I hope your answer is because of me. That's your answer. But in Isaiah, turn to Isaiah with me. Why does this take place? God told Israel what was going to happen. Isaiah chapter 52, talking about the coming Messiah. Isaiah chapter 52, look at verse 14. Again, this is talking about the Messiah. Verse 14 of Isaiah 52 says, as many were astonished, in other words, astonished at his visage, in other words, his appearance. So many were astonished at his appearance, so marred more than any man, in his form more than the sons of men. The so marred is pointing in this verse, this so marred, two little words that doesn't do justice to what it's really trying to convey here. This so marred is pointing to the depth of the humiliation that Jesus faced in this trial. The Lord of all creation facing this completely unjust trial before those who should have bowed down before him, they spit in his face, literally, punched him. They tried him in legal manners, in legal ways, trying to call false witnesses, his friends who, for whatever reason, fear, wouldn't come forward and speak on his behalf. So marred, pointing to the depth of his humiliation. Why did the Lord allow this to happen? Why did he allow this to happen? Look at chapter 53 of Isaiah. This despicable thing that took place. Just because God ordained it to happen doesn't mean those involved were exempt or justified in their action. Not at all. Not at all. Isaiah chapter 53. Pick up in verse 4 here. Isaiah 53, 4. Well, verse 3. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised and we esteemed him not. Who's this talking about? Jesus. Talking about the time of his earthly ministry, particularly his trial. Verse 4, surely he had borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. And with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter and as a sheep before her shearer dumb, so he opened not his mouth. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off from the land of the living for the transgression of my people. Was he stricken? And he made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. It had pleased the Lord to bruise him. He had put him to grief. Now shall make his soul an offering for sin. He shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He shall see of the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. You see, God sees this injustice done to Jesus in order to justify us. So bad is sin that the picture of dealing with it had to be equally troubled. That when the world would look at someone so marred, it couldn't be recognized. The picture of sin might be before mankind in a real way. Why did this happen? Why did Jesus allow it to happen? For us. So we began a series talking about perfect justice and how perfectly fair Jesus is. And what started it was a look at the fact that Jesus wouldn't even favor his own brothers, half-brothers, the ones who were born to Mary and Joseph after he was born, and they themselves did not even know that he was the Messiah, because Jesus was so fair that he didn't pull them aside and say, hey, by the way, when I turn 30 and I start doing these things, you should believe me. No, he treated them exactly the same. Jesus was so perfectly fair and perfectly just that he went, just as the scriptures said, quiet, willing to be so marred so that we might put on his righteousness. And so when we think of how marred he was, and we think of how perfectly beautiful he is, realize that that justification is something you have as a result of him going through this. I see in all of this God, people need to be told about. We start by telling them the gospel. The world out there right now, they think that Christians are foolish. We serve a God who's not fair, who's not just. I've said this more than once. God was not fair to anybody, so himself.